Please join us in Los Angeles for the 64th annual OA Birthday Party. It's on Friday, January 12th to Sunday, January 14th, 2024. Together we get better. In person at the LAX Hilton. Please visit oalig.org to book your room at a discounted rate. Registration opens in October 2023.
Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
Hi, everybody. I'm Michael, and I'm a compulsive overeater. Thank you so much for having me here to Kitchen Sink to talk to you today. You never know when to start and how to start these shares. But I was thinking the other day about a poem that I'm not big for poetry, but years ago I was at a wedding, and on everybody's place setting, they had this little, the bride and groom had put this little poem. And it's called Wild Things. It's by a very well-known poet named Mary Oliver. She's pretty famous, at least I'm told. I'm just going to read the start, the first couple lines. It starts, "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves." And, you know, that struck me. Because I just thought, how simple is that? How clear and simple, right? You do not have to be good. You do not have to be everything. And for me and my journey in compulsive overeating, so much of it was literally fed into me and by me on this concept of, I have to be everything. I have to do this. I have to fit in. There was some have to attached to everything. And under the weight of that and the expectations of that, I fell into this disease. I grew up in Philadelphia. My father worked in a garage. My mother was a housewife. I had 3 older brothers. We lived in a very modest brick twin in a working class neighborhood. And, you know, when you grow up in a really sort of strict Irish Catholic family, which had a fair amount of levity, you know, I've joked often, and some of you who know my story have heard me say that we were the Kennedys without the money. And when you grow up in that sort of environment, there's a stricture to it. There is an expected structure. That's what makes it work. You know, I was raised with a lot of structure. We went to church every Sunday. We saw my grandmother every Saturday. We, you know, dinner was every night at 6. Like, we did our homework at this time. I mean, we went to bed at this time. There was a lot of structure, which really, for somebody like me who was sort of a dreamer and a little bit immature growing up, it really helped. You know what I mean? That kind of structure helped. The problem is there's a flip side to that. There's a dark side to that kind of thing, which is there's an expectation that you will behave in a certain way and you will be a certain way. And if you are not that way, if you are somebody like me who was creative, artistic, and sensitive in a really sort of hurly-burly family where things like, you know, sort of being clever and athletic ability and, you know, manliness, I mean, I had 3 older brothers, were expected, didn't always go well. Because I wasn't understood. And when you're not understood, you have 2 choices. You can try to make the people around you understand you, or you can try to meld yourself into what they're telling you you should be. And as a child, it's hard to stand up for yourself. I always admire the children who do, but I wasn't one of them. I was too afraid of losing my place in my family. And so I tried to adapt myself and suppress the parts of myself that I thought were not helpful in their understanding of me. And as a result, I spent an extraordinary amount of time alone. My brothers were 5, 7, and 10 years older than I am. So by the time I was 8 and they were 13, 15, and 18, they had the teenage thing going. Nobody wanted to hang out with their 8-year-old brother. I had my diversions of my paint-by-number sets and my Hardy Boys books, and that helped. But it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to combat the loneliness, and it certainly wasn't enough to combat the constant feeling of being other in this unit. And when you feel other, you need something to soothe, you need something to get by. And I found food, and I found food early. My mother, who was vivacious and gregarious and quite fun, but again, when I was young, she retired early from housewifery. And by that, I mean, she did the cooking, she did the cleaning, she did all that. But in terms of being invested in my happiness, not so much. My aunts all lived on the block, and she had a really active social life with them. And she loved to go to the tavern and have a good veal parm and a beer. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. But again, it backflipped on me in leaving me alone for an extraordinary amount of time. What happened then is that with the food to comfort me, they were more than willing to shove it at me. And then that was it. I was off to the races. I was a compulsive eater before I had any idea of what that was or what I was doing. There's nothing tougher or more Darwinian than being a fat adolescent, especially if you go to an urban Catholic school, as I did. It was tough. And so I went to public high school. I couldn't wait to get out and start over. And I thought, well, I'm going to start over. I'm not going to be fat for 4 more years and be bullied. I'm going to get really thin. I took up boxing and lost it, long distance running, and got really, really, really skinny, discovering the flip side of our disorder, which is restricting. Spent years restricting, spent years skinny, and thought that would solve everything. It didn't, of course, because that's what you learn long term, right? If only we'd learn these things young. But the journey is the journey. And as I look back on this now, I understand that you have to embrace your journey. You cannot spend your life in regret. You cannot spend your life saying, oh my gosh, why did I do that when I was 15? I still do that late at night. I look up at the bedroom ceiling, and if I can't sleep, I relitigate my past and say, if only I had done this and this and this, then everything would be good. But it's an illusion. And the program tells us it's a powerful illusion. You know, we did the best we could with what we had at the time we had it. I made a ton of mistakes. And that included being in the food and then being radically out of the food. I don't think people sometimes realize that restricting can be just as damaging and awful as being in the food. Starving yourself is not fun. It's not healthy, and it doesn't do anything for you. What eventually happened is that you end up on a roller coaster, at least I did, right? Which is something bad happens. I get broken up with. I lose my job, something, you know, whatever. And then I go back into the food and I get really large again. And that lasts for a couple of years. And then I get tired of that. And then I'm like, I don't want to be fat anymore. I'm going to restrict. And then right back. And then after like, say, 6 to 8 months of eating seaweed and water, I then become really skinny. And then I'm like, okay. And I'm always waiting for the reward. I'm always waiting for the part that says, bam, okay, now we're good. Except inside, I'm still broken into a million pieces. It never occurs to me that the food, whether I have a lot of it or none of it, is all symptomatic of a larger issue. I have no spiritual life. I have no connection to something greater than me. I'm completely self-obsessed, and I'm constantly chasing what I can't have. I grow up into an adult who only wants what he can't have. In my relationships, which have not been successful, it's because I only chased people who would not love me back. I only chased people whose love I had to earn. If you were into me, if you said to me the worst thing you could have said to me in my 20s, 30s, and even my 40s was, oh, you're really great. You know, I'd love to date you. Like, no. What? What are you looking at? You must be nuts. But if you came to me and you were like, I don't know, maybe, probably not, but then wham, I came after you. Because that felt comfortable to me. That felt familiar to me. Because just like when I was a child, having to earn my place in my family by adapting who I was to get that love and support, that's what I knew as an adult. Well, then I have to earn this. I have to fight for it. If I don't have to fight for it, it's not worth having. That brokenness all inside, constantly showing up in my overeating and my restricting. You know, you get to a point where you've had enough. And I wish that I had had enough when I was like 40 instead of having enough when I was 57. But we don't control these things. The pandemic was a huge gift to those of us who are compulsive overeaters. You know, right before that, I tell the story that I was going to parties and I had really started isolating hard even before the pandemic. And I tell a story where I was standing at a party and I've always said there's nothing worse than two thin people standing at a party arguing over who's fatter. And you're standing there with them and you're thinking, okay, if you're arguing over who you, of the two of you who thinks, what are you saying about me when I'm in the men's room? Like, and I would stand there and I would boil inside in resentment. And my answer was to leave the party as soon as possible and then begin the calculation, right? We all have the calculation in our head. How many drive-throughs are between here and home? What stores are still open? If I have this, this, and this, could I also have that? Can I bake this? Is there enough time? Like the crazy in your head, going away on vacation with people and hiding donuts in my drawer, like thinking that somehow this was a normal behavior and then waiting for everybody to go to bed so then I could stay up and binge. And then taking all the boxes and wrappers, putting them in my car, and then driving to a public trash receptacle to throw them out so that nobody knew that I had done it. Like, and never bothering to put up a stop sign and say, you know what? This is not normal. This is not healthy. There's something off here. Because I didn't have that capacity. I didn't have that alacrity. And I didn't have it because I was simply trying to cope and survive. You're simply trying to keep going. The pandemic happened. I gained 35 additional pounds. I was already quite large. And I literally had nothing left to wear. And one day in August of 2020, I reached the point where I'd had it. My father had died a couple years earlier. He had been in AA and had a remarkable second chapter of 25 years of sobriety, which I got to watch up close. And I was talking to him and I just said, I can't do this. I just can't do this another day. I don't know what to do. Like, can you get me where you are? And I wouldn't have harmed myself, but I wouldn't have minded a massive heart attack because I just wanted out. I just had had it. And I heard him tell me go to bed. So I did. And the next day I went to an OA meeting and I didn't want to go. I was really grumpy. It was on Zoom. I saw a bunch of squares like this. But I raised my hand when they said, are you new? And I just thought, this is it. I have nothing left to lose except my unhappiness, except my brokenness. And day by day, I came back. I didn't know what the prayers were. I had no idea how the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous applied to overeating. To me, it seemed strange. I bought the 12 and 12. I found a sponsor who was 30 years younger, but he had what I wanted. He's still my sponsor today. And I started my trudge through the steps. One was easy, right? I find one to be very easy, admitting you're powerless, because believe me, I'd had it. Like that moment when you're on your knees on the floor and you're just subsumed in sugar and flour, I'd done. Two and three were harder because I had no spiritual life. I had been raised Catholic and I know a lot of people get on here and they bash the Catholics and I get it. I mean, you know, whatever. As a gay man, they don't really want me as part of their group. And I totally understand that. Like, I think people get to decide who's in their group and who isn't, what the rules are. But I did miss the rituals of Catholicism. I missed the incense, the stained glass, the quiet, the organ. I mean, those things as a child helped me a lot, actually. They gave me a sense of solemnity, which I really latched on to when things were tough. But, you know, you can't just light a candle and buy a stained glass window and put it up and then say, okay, oh, we're done. It's not how it works. So the work was in two and three. I did a lot of step work around two and three, and it took me, quite frankly, a long time. That's why when I sponsor people now, I do not rush them. I'm not like the sponsor on the phone saying, well, how many questions did you do today? Because some of these steps take longer for different people given their life experience. You know what I mean? It certainly was that case for me. I had a very patient sponsor who, you know, was on me, but was also loving and gentle, which is what I really needed. And gradually, you know, it starts to work, right? The miracles happen. You start to lose weight. You have a food plan. It all starts to come together. And there's a sense of disbelief, at least for there was for me. I was like, wow, this is really crazy that this is working. Like, I didn't think it would work because I didn't want it. And I didn't want to have to be part of it. And I certainly didn't embrace the part that said, guess what? You never graduate from this. The graduation song from OA is, welcome to McDonald's, may I take your order? And I thought, am I really never having fast food again? Am I really never having sugar, recreational sugar again? And the answer was, yes, that is exactly what's happening. But the key for me was to say, okay, I don't know if that's true, but I know it's true today. The one day at a time thing was critical for me. Absolutely critical. If you try to look too far in ahead, at least for me, that's danger. That is that my disease is out there waiting, saying, ha, you think you're going to make it 3 months? Good luck. But if I say, you know what? I don't know if I'm going to make it 3 months. I don't know if I'm going to make it 3 weeks. I don't know if I'm going to make it 3 days, but I'm going to make it today. Today, I'm going to stick to this and I'm going to do this today. And by the time I go to bed tonight, I will have had a successful day. That's it. That's all I can do. I do the daily readers every day. I make calls. I go to meetings. I have a very structured program on purpose because I know me. Because that six-year-old me who wanted the box of donuts is still in there. And he's calmer now. And he's a lot happier now. And he's a lot more fulfilled now. But you know what? He still raises the occasional tantrum where he just like, I don't feel like doing a reading. I want cake. And I have to be gentle with him. I think that's also one of the things I've learned the most in program is to be gentle with myself. One of the hardest things I've ever done is getting to the point of looking in a mirror and saying, I love you and meaning it. The first time I did it, I thought, you're lying. You don't really love yourself. And I didn't. I wasn't there yet. It's a process. The whole thing about this whole program is it's a process. You have to embrace the journey. And when I think about myself in OA, I think about my higher power, whatever that is, holding my hand and keeping me on a path like the yellow brick road, right? And as long as I keep my hand in my higher power's hand, I won't veer off the path. I know I can feel it when I'm veering off the path. I can feel it when I'm up against the bumper and when I'm in the weeds. And that's when I activate my program even further. I will call more people. I will go to more meetings. I will read more literature. I will do more writing. Because staying on the path is my only job. That's the only thing I have to do. If I stay connected to my higher power and I keep on the path. It doesn't matter how slowly I walk on the path. It doesn't matter. Am I on the path? That's the only thing that matters is that I stay where I'm supposed to stay. And trust. Is that
Michael? Yeah, 5 minutes. Yeah.
Thank you. That I stay on the path and that I keep walking one step at a time. I do not always win against the disease. I was on vacation last week in Costa Rica and at a big villa with friends. And my six-year-old pulled a sneak attack. I ended up seeing a picture on social media of all my friends I was on the trip with, and they were all at lunch together and had invited me. And man, I got to tell you, like, it was like literally being back in 1970, like all over again. It was insane. Like the anger I felt at being excluded, of being othered, right? Of not belonging, of being excluded, of having to earn entry, all of it came rushing in. It was like being filled up with water, boiling water. As a result, I tried to do the program stuff. I called my sponsor. You know, I called into a meeting. Here's the thing. It didn't work. And that's the hard truth. Sometimes we lose. Sometimes the disease wins. Now, the disease did not win the whole war. Okay. I didn't eat over it. So I won the war. Higher power and I won the war. I lost the battle. And I lost the battle because that night at the farewell dinner, I sat and sulked and pouted and was furious with all of them. When there was a perfectly good explanation of how that happened, of course, which I found out later, but I was too enraged. And I ruined the farewell dinner of this huge trip. The next day, realizing this and calming down, and then after doing the work and sort of pulling myself back together and getting the boiling water to recede, which is what happens, I had to go on an amends tour. I literally went through the San Jose, Costa Rica airport from gate to gate, finding people as they were flying out to their various destinations, and apologized in person to every person I could find. I found 12 of the 15 guys on the trip. It was humiliating, frankly, but I did it. I thought, this is it. This is what they mean. This is living the program, right? My side of the street is suddenly filthy. I've got to get out my push broom and I've got to clean this up right now because this is not who we are. We are not the bitter, angry, resentful person who came in 3 years ago. We did not do all of this work to be a terrible person. That is not how it works. And at that point, I had no idea how that lunch happened. And I thought to myself, it doesn't matter how it happened. You have behaved badly. And I'm so grateful. I am so grateful that God interceded and said, on you, kiddo. This is on you. And made me go do it. Because with each amends I made, I felt the weight lifting. I felt that emotional sort of garbage that we all carry getting lighter. There were three of them I couldn't find. I wrote them all. I ended up talking to my friend Dan, whose birthday it was, on the phone. And he gave me the best set of grace I could have asked for. We had a long talk. And I said, Dan, I'll always be the guy. And Dan's also in recovery in AA. And I said, I'll always be the guy who ruined your farewell dinner. And he was quiet. And he said to me, no, you'll always be the guy who got sick at my farewell dinner. How much grace is that to have somebody say that to you, to accept that, right? To carry that for you. And that's what this is. That's what I get from recovery. That's what I get from living in the 12 steps. I get forgiveness, right? You get forgiveness from other people, and I get to forgive myself. I get to look back in the mirror and say, you know what? I do love you, and you're doing the best you can. And yes, that was not a good day, but you know what? You didn't eat over it, and you cleaned it up right away. I get to emphasize the good things. I get to think about the positive things that I did instead of just beating the crap out of myself all the time, because there is no recovery in that for me. None. I'll close with this. At the end of the Mary Oliver poem, it says this: whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Thank you for being my family, and thank you so much for letting me share with you today. Okay, this is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you asked a question last week, please wait until the first three questions have been asked before raising your hand. If you have a question, please raise the raise hand icon.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for your awesome share. You are my brother from another mother. You skirted over something at the very end of your share, kind of a loaded question. I'm paraphrasing. You said, I could look back in the mirror and say, I love you, which that's huge. And I would like to know, how did you come to be able to look in the mirror and say, I love you?
The great question. How did I come to look in the mirror and say, I love you? Wow, this is really a journey. Yeah, I was sort of the opposite of the queen in Snow White. You know what I mean? Like, who's the fairest of them all? I'm like everybody else. But I think when I think back on what I used to tell myself when I was really large and had gained a tremendous amount of weight, and of course you avoid mirrors at any cost. And I would see myself passing in a department store mirror or whatever. And I mean, the things I used to say to myself, I would never say to another living person. I mean, they were brutal, vicious things. You know what I mean? And I think for me, what happened is that the step work gradually chips away at that. The step work, each step, and I think there's a reason they're called steps, right? I think that's brilliant, the guys who invented this whole program, right? Because steps ascend, right? You there's a sense of a journey up somewhere towards something bigger and larger and more munificent. And I really metaphorically kept that in my head as I was doing it, because that was my goal. My goal was to not hate myself. Because hating myself was so much a part of my disease. I used to eat at myself all the time. You suck, you're terrible. Yeah, and then shove it all in because you're trying to numb it, right? You're trying to feel nothing. To me, it wasn't about the food tasting good or giving me a high. To me, the food was anesthesia. You know, I don't want to feel X, and so I'm going to numb out until I don't feel it. The thing about it is that, you know, people don't like to admit is that it works, right? The food will do that. It will send you into a coma. Like it happened all the time, right? That's why we do it. But it doesn't last. And the after effects are much worse than what precipitated it. For me, getting to the I love you part and meaning it was the real meaningful part. My sponsor said, I want you to look in the mirror and say, I love you. And so the first time I did it, And I almost burst out laughing because I thought, you're lying. You don't. And I called my sponsor back and said, well, I did your little, you know, and I said it was a joke. And he's like, it doesn't matter. One day you'll be able to do it and mean it. I want you to keep doing it every day. And every day, after I brushed my teeth, I'd look in the mirror and say, I love you, Michael. And then I'd be like, mm-hmm, sure you do. But I kept doing it. I kept doing it. And as I did the step work, and as I started to stitch that brokenness inside back together, a little bit of glue at a time, there got to a point where one day I brushed my teeth, I looked in the mirror and I said, I love you. And I thought, yeah, I kind of do. I kind of do. I kind of see you're doing the best you can. And you're basically a decent person. And this has been a rough road. And you know what? You're on it. And you could, for years, you weren't on it. And that's enough. And that became my new mantra. I love you and you're enough. Full stop. That's it. And I say it all the time. Sean.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah. Thank you for everything. You've been a huge part of my recovery. Love you, brother. And I heard you say the patient and loving when that your sponsor was to you. What are your keys or when you take guys through the steps or sponsor, and what are some of the key points that you think are important?
That's a great question. You know, I have two sponsees now. I had two others who dropped me for various reasons. I mean, one left the program and then one just felt I wasn't the right person for them, which is fine. I mean, I think that's also progress, is that rejection part of like, hold it, I've been fired, you know, is easy to sort of take on too. And I sort of let that go of like, you know what? It's okay. It's all good. When I take people through the steps, I find it really rewarding because it reminds me, I mean, having to reread the steps and go through the workbook again every time is sort of a refresher course for me. So it's bonus for me. I think sponsoring is a critical part of my recovery. And for me, the most important part of sponsoring is that I only have one rule with my sponsees because it worked for me. And I just said, I don't care what you tell me. I don't care what you do. You must not lie to me. If I find out that you have lied to me, I will drop you, because that is our covenant. Our covenant is this is a safe space and we are always honest with each other. No matter what happens out in the world, whatever you do, you cannot lie to me and I will never lie to you. That's the promise. And I think that's very sacred and it's integral to the success of a program. My program is built on rigorous honesty. I would never lie to my sponsor. I couldn't imagine it. And I have told him some really embarrassing things. And I have stumbled and fumbled and staggered and had to call him and say, I mean, this whole last episode in Costa Rica, I mean, who wants to call and have to report that, you know? But I was like, well, this is it. And the thing is, he would never judge me and I would never judge my sponsees. That's the beauty of this. The beauty is we don't judge each other because we're all in the boat together. We all know what this is like. We all know we're a mess. Like, we wouldn't be here on a Saturday morning looking at each other in squares across the country if we were all perfectly good. That's not how it works. So for me, the rigorous honesty part is the key to the sponsee-sponsor relationship. You know, I've had sponsees call and say, I binged last night and I did this, or I yelled at somebody, or that's okay. You know what? We can work it all out. You know, it's okay. Nobody is perfect. It's like the poem I started with, right? You do not have to be good, but you do have to be honest. Bob.
Yes, thank you very much for your share. How important is service to your program?
Great question too. How important is service? Service for me, you know, like many people who enter into OA, when I first came in, the last thing I was going to do was service, right? You want to be on the meeting as little as possible. I said nothing. I never raised my hand. I didn't recite any of the prayers. I didn't buy any of the literature. I didn't get a sponsor right away. I mean, I was the lurker, right? Because there's still that part of you in your head that says, you probably don't need this. And you'll prove to yourself you don't need it by coming to a few of these and not getting anything out of it. Like, it's this sort of weird thing that your brain says because you don't want to be in this group. I certainly didn't. And then, of course, you find out, guess what? All of these people are exactly like you and they have the solution. And if you are not an idiot, you can find it. And to me, service was the way to maintain it. Once I got through the shaky part, right? You know, you go through the sugar detox and you're through the first couple of steps, you latch onto that concept of a higher power and it actually means something to you. You're off to the races and then you're like, okay, I have to actively participate in my recovery. And that was something my sponsor was really good about. And he was like, you must be active in this. You cannot be passive. You cannot window shop your way through the program. It's not how it works. That's why there's a whole chapter called How It Works, literally, that lays it out. And you cannot keep what you don't give away. That's another axiom. You know, we're full of axioms in a way, but that one really resonates with me as well. You know, I believe that firmly, that I cannot keep what I don't give away. And so I started doing readings at meetings. That was how I started. And then, you know, gradually I became, you know, the speaker getter at one and the treasurer. And, you know, I've been a secretary. And frankly, like, it isn't because I love it. You know, it's a responsibility and nobody wants added responsibility in an already busy life, but it's critical to me because if I don't do that, if I don't pass it on, I don't get to keep it. And selfishly, I want to keep it. Deb.
Thanks so much, Michael. What about relationships? How did they change for you, you know, before recovery and now working the program? What's that like for you?
Wow. there's a few people on the Zoom who have heard me answer this kind of question, which is why I'm laughing. My relationships, my love relationships, let's start there, have been always a disaster for the reason because I was just broken and I wasn't healthy enough to sustain one. So people look back and I'm always amazed at people who have come into recovery and they're like, oh, I've been married 20 years. And I'm like, I couldn't make 20 days. So my love relationships never worked out because of what I had said earlier, because I was always chasing some elusive dream of what I thought, you know, would then make me validate it, right? So if I chase you and then you turn around and love me back, I've earned it, and therefore I must be worth something. That's proof. See, it's like tangible, especially if you were better looking. That was the bonus. But of course it never works out because you end up chasing inappropriate people, you know? And so what a shock. Like, it doesn't work. I had some, you know, relationships, one lasted a year. And obviously, and ironically, before I came out of the closet, I had very long-term relationships with women, but I always picked women who were really clingy and who were, you know, who I could control. I mean, it was all part of the illusion, right? I mean, the amends tour I had to go there was not pretty, but, you know, my relationships today are very different. I have just now at the age of 60 started to date healthily, which is a very advanced age to start dating healthily, but better late than never, right? I had sort of given up on the idea of dating. I just thought, you know what, the window closed. It's not for me. And even after recovery, I went on some dates and that didn't work out. And I just thought, seeing some things never change. But now I'm dating somebody now, and I don't know if this is going to work out. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not guaranteed anything. Like, I'm not. But the fact that I'm doing it is enough. It comes back to that thing of like, you know what? I love you and it's enough. Like, that's it. And letting go of the outcome, the ability to let go of other people and their behavior. And this is also true in my relationship with my own family. You know what I mean? I told my family that I was in when I had to do my ninth step, I owed them a bunch of amends. I had to come out to them and say, oh, you know, I'm in this thing. Here's what's happening. And, you know, food is a weird thing. People don't get it. They're like, well, you're addicted to food? Like, what? We just thought you were fat. Like, no. But it's definitely healthier because I'm more present and I have better boundaries with them, frankly, which has made a better relationship with me. I did a lot of people pleasing in my family as a result of my childhood, and now I don't. And that doesn't mean I'm an asshole and just, you know, who tells them no all the time. But for example, I'm not going home for Christmas this year. I now live in LA, and I just said to them in the summer, look, it's too much. I need a year off and I'm not coming. And they're really disappointed. They're really bummed. I've never missed a Christmas with them. But you know what? It's the healthy choice for me. And I just said, I need you to be good with this. And I suspect they're not really good with it, but they're play acting that they're good with it. And that's enough, right? I can't, again, their behavior, not my thing, not on me to take their inventory. It's just to do the next right thing for me. And that's all I can do. Muniza.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for your wonderful share on your honesty. So much of it resonated. My question is, how do you stay consistent with program, especially when it comes to relationships? Because I hear what you're saying. You seem like a male version of basically me, because I've been through two marriages. And at this time, I've been asked by my sponsor not to date because I don't like myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm really dragging through step 9, you know, just having a hard time finishing it. And she's asked me not to date. She said, you will keep choosing those shitty men that you always do, Muniza. So just stop. Love yourself. Get better. Get recovery. Then get back into it. So love what you said. Everything you said, including your family. I'm from a big family. All of that. The people pleasing. The bending over backwards. All of that. me, you know? Anyway, so tell me about program. Tell me how you stay consistent with program to stay in recovery.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for those kind words. I stay, you know, it's funny because, you know, the promises are all about like fear will leave us. And that is basically true, but I will tell you that I do live with what I call an acceptable level of fear. And by that, I mean, I am fearful of losing my recovery. I am at a place now, ironically, this week, where I've made a bunch of outreach calls and 3 of my fellows are in relapse. And I didn't know, but I haven't seen them around. And that's always the first clue. You stop seeing people. And so I'm calling and I'm like, hey, haven't seen you. What's, you know, some people don't call you back because they're really out. But I had a couple of them call me finally, and they were like, yeah, I'm back in the food and I don't know what to do and blah, blah, blah. And to me, that triggers a really low, I call a low hum of anxiety, but to me, it's actually helpful You know, it's funny. It's also goes back to like our character defects sometimes help us. And to me, it sort of triggers that idea that, see, this is what's on the other side. If you decide to get rid of this, because frankly, some days I've had it. Some days I just don't want to do it. I don't want to be the speaker, and I don't want to go to meetings, and I don't want to hear, you know, I mean, people's shares are great. And then some shares, frankly, aren't great. I mean, objectively speaking, I don't want to hear about your sister-in-law and how she, you know, barred your car. And like, I sit there and I get agitated, you know, but you have to keep your eye on the prize. And to me, it's all part of the same mix. I don't get to cherry pick, you know, it's not a menu, ironically. It's a whole thing. You're in or you're out. And I do it because I know it's this or it's that. It's a very binary choice for me. And if I don't stick to this, if I don't do it every day, if I don't pick up my four today and my Voices of Recovery and start my day with that, it doesn't go well. Like, I am always one episode away from driving to a drive-through. And then that's it. You know, then I know I'm not going to be this person who, like, I go to meetings, people say, oh, I had a slip. I'm like, oh no, my slip would be a ski jump. Like, if I end up at the drive-through, it's over. Like, I'm going to be in relapse for God knows how long, maybe forever. And I hear that and I'm just like, no. So that low level fear of like, of knowing, of having a vivid picture of what my life was like and what it will be like if I do it, keeps me on my yellow brick road, hand in with HP. Thank you so much. And thank you all for those great questions.